Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, how is the anti-government movement a type of constitutional coup? And first, tons of discarded plastic are choking off the oceans, killing wildlife, and building islands of garbage. How bad has it become, and what can be done about it?
The ocean is awash with plastic, so much so that giant patches of discarded plastic items, toothbrushes, bottles, bags, are forming in the Pacific Ocean. Plastic pieces are killing off wildlife that swallow or get choked by them. What can be done about the mounds and mounds of plastic that is killing off our ocean life? With us is Charles Moore. He is the founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute in Long Beach and a captain in the U.S. Merchant Marine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Charles Moore. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be with you.
So you recently returned from a trip to research these garbage patches in the ocean. If you could start helping us understand what exactly these garbage patches are and how many are there.
They are fairly stable current systems in the ocean that are under high pressure cells, and they are north and south of the equator about the latitude of terrestrial deserts. So they're what we call the subtropics. They're in between the equatorial zone, which is tropical, and the northern zone, which is arctic and cold. So this is moderate temperatures and dominated by high pressure. High pressure simply means that the weight of the atmosphere above these areas is greater than in other parts of the Earth. That's because the air is heated at the equator and rises and creates these mountains of air over the mid-latitudes before they condense and come down in the poles. So this mountain of air that's over these subtropical zones descends in a clockwise rotation in the northern hemisphere and in a counterclockwise rotation in the southern hemisphere. And as it descends in this gentle movement, it pulls on the surface of the ocean. So over time, it creates very stable, either clockwise currents that rotate and scour the coastlines of the associated continents, or in the southern hemisphere, counterclockwise rotations that do the same thing. So basically what you have is a kind of a toilet bowl effect, I call it, where you're scouring the edges of the toilet bowl, which is the continents that release most of this debris, and bringing it into the center, which acts as a kind of a accumulator for the trash. A lot of people ask me, well, is the gyre getting bigger? No, the gyres are determined by these geostrophic forces, so it's not the gyres that are increasing in size. What's happening is that the debris that is being accumulated by these gyres is increasing, and so we're starting to see it on the periphery more and not just in the center of these garbage patches.
There are how many garbage patches now?
Five major ones, North and South Atlantic, North and South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean are the major oceanic gyres, and they cover approximately 40% of the world ocean, which, if you work that out, it's close to a quarter of the Earth's surface is actually these gyres. Now, they're all remote from land, so they're not a place where, say, for instance, a recreational boater or even a commercial boater would hang out. The same forces that create a terrestrial desert are creating these oceanic deserts, and because they're in the deep ocean away from land, and they're not in, you know, Arctic areas where there's a lot of runoff and they're getting a lot of nutrients, they're nutrient poor. They're what we call depauperate. So in the same sense that a terrestrial desert is devoid of life, except for some hardy species, that's also true of these garbage patches. The only thing I would say that differentiates them from a terrestrial desert is that there's a lot of ocean juvenile species that go to these gyres because they're devoid of large predators to grow up. So small sea turtles and small mola mola, a kind of a fish without a tail that grows to an enormous size. These juveniles hang out in these gyres, these garbage patches. So the fact is that they don't have a lot of life, but the life that they do have is at a very important life stage when it's growing up there. And the fact that we're filling it up with all this plastic waste is having a devastating effect on those juvenile species.
So these gyres are really just islands of plastic garbage.
I would call them more a soup of plastic garbage, not an island. When I first discovered it in 1997, it was just a piece here and a piece there. We didn't really take research equipment out there till 1999 and trawl and get quantitative estimates of the amount of plastic in these garbage patches. So it's been 15 years since we really started measuring and monitoring. And what we do out there is unique in the world of garbage gyres, because most people don't have the wherewithal to go except for one trip on a very sporadic basis. But we've actually been back to the same 11 stations and monitored them over this 15-year period. So we have a running data set of how it's been changing, and I can tell you it's been changing dramatically for the worse. It's growing in quantity of the debris. Now, when I first went out there, people said to me, well, what is it like? Are you like an icebreaker going through, you know, plastic waste that you're just bumping out of your way? And I said, oh, no, it's nothing like that. It's just a piece here, and maybe 5 minutes later I'd see another piece. Well, you know, 10 years after that, it was about 10 pieces per minute that we would spot. So it had increased. Now, and 15 years later, in 2014, there's so much stuff there that it is like being an icebreaker. You're going through so much junk, and you can't even count how much is going by the boat. It's that much worse.
Where is it predominantly coming from? Or is this coming from everybody all over the world throwing plastic into the trash?
We always want to combat pollution by looking to find the worst and combat that first. It's just the way that resources are allocated. You allocate resources to combating the worst first. But in the case of plastic pollution, it's such a what we call a non-point source pollutant that you can't locate the worst offender. You try as you will, you can't find who's the worst, because there is no single individual source. It's not a point source, it's a non-point source. And now that even the remotest tribes and the most primitive civilizations wear polyester T-shirts that they've been given by somebody who's visited there, these polyester T-shirts are shedding thousands of fragments every time they're washed. Everybody on the planet now is a contributor. These polyester fragments have gotten so much into the seafood that the average European shellfish eater was just shown in a study to consume 11,000 synthetic fibers in their shellfish consumption each year. So these fibers are everywhere in the environment. These garbage patches accumulate the floating stuff, but the stuff that sinks to the bottom is in somewhere else. We've fundamentally change the nature of the ocean itself into the synthetic polymer soup. And I don't think we have anywhere near the information that we need to say what the consequences of that are. But we do know for a fact that the consequences are deleterious, that millions of animals are dying, starving, being strangled, and caught by this trash. And so it's a dire scenario that is very little understood.
You said in your op-ed piece in the New York Times that plastics are the most common pollutants, but they're also as dangerous as climate change to life on Earth.
Well, what I said in my editorial was that it's a hypothesis that should be seriously tested. What happens with climate change is you get migration toward the poles, right? Things heat up at the equator and things can move. So you do lose species that can't maneuver out of the heat that's being generated and find a more temperate living space that corresponds to what they're used to. But humans can do that. Maybe a smart investment is buying real estate in northern Canada or Siberia or Patagonia or, you know, Tasmania, because we can move out of the way of some of these phenomena that are affecting the planet. But when you're caught in a net of plastic, you can't get away. It's a ghost fishing, they call it, and it's extremely destructive. And the traps that fishermen put out get lost about 10% of them each year, and they are responsible for decimating about 10% of the target catch. So in addition to this kind of getting caught and tangled up in the stuff, there's this other phenomenon where these plastics accumulate pollutants, and they break into these bite-sized bits, and everything we found out there had bite marks on it. It's being chewed up. The ocean is a very sparse place. Animals have to swim a long way to find something to eat. So when they find anything that looks edible, they're going to sample it. And everything is getting sampled. All this trash has been completely chewed around the edges. And these bits that the animals are eating are poison pills. They're up to a million times the level of the pollutants in the surrounding seawater have been sponged up by these bits and are then transmitted through the food web. So you're getting a non-nutritive, non-digestible food mimic put into all these different species. Hundreds of species now have been identified as consuming this stuff. And so it's weakening the fitness of the marine life itself. This needs to be compared to what's happening with climate change and studied.
Let's turn to solutions. You've not been an advocate of recycling because there are some problems there. What are the problems with recycling?
Plastic is not like metal. The age of steel was characterized by a lot of recycling, all right? When replaced steel with plastic in 1979, the production of plastic in the United States outstripped production of steel. When that happened, you got a material that in the first time in really modern human civilization, the product that defines the age of plastic, that product is not really recyclable in any major way. It has too many problems associated with it. Let me enumerate the problems. First of all, there's too many different types of plastics. You can't mix polycarbonate plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic and get a usable plastic. You can't mix polyethylene plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic or with PET plastic, polyethylene terephthalate, and get a usable material. You've got to separate them, but this is not what's done in manufacturing. In manufacturing, they're mixed together because they're used. One might be used for the cap. That's the polypropylene is the cap on most bottles. Then the bottle itself can be polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate, so it's a totally different plastic. They have to be separated. Then the labeling may be a thin sheet of plastic of another type. Then with your potato chip bags, you've got a sheet of aluminum that's been electroplated onto the plastic to keep moisture in from penetrating so the potato chips stay crisp. That's a whole another layer of problems. Or your Tetra Pak, where you're getting your milk and your soups and your juices in these cardboard packs. There's many layers there that are a nightmare to recycle. Only very few plants are equipped to even tear those things apart and try to get at recycling them. Then when you finally get the stuff separated, you've got to try to clean it, because if you don't clean it, it's not going to be purified in the remelting process. It starts melting at the boiling point of water, about 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. That's when your plastics start to melt. This is not going to vaporize greases, oils, contaminants, paints, all the things that you get rid of when you recycle steel or you recycle glass or you recycle aluminum. All those contaminants that get vaporized off and you get that clean metal substrate, that doesn't happen with plastic. So it's illegal to have food contact with recycled plastic because it doesn't get rid of bacteria. Even some nurserymen won't take pots for potted plants out of recycled plastic because they still contain viruses and bacteria that can harm the plant. So it's not purified in the remelting recycling process. So cleaning is very hard. Cleaning this stuff is very difficult because the plastic molecule is an open molecule that is very easy to suck up oily substances. That's why it's used in cleaning up oil spills. All those booms you see around oil spills are made out of plastic because plastic separates oil from water. It will suck up the oil and leave the water. Well, in sucking up the oil, it sucks up all the associated contaminants. So trying to clean that, you really have a hard time. If you've ever tried to maybe reuse a cup that you had some top ramen noodles that you did in the microwave and that little ring of chicken fat, that yellow ring, tried to wash that off with soap and water, it's a very difficult process. The stuff really sticks into the plastic matrix. So you don't purify it when you recycle it, and you have one heck of a time sorting it when you recycle it. Then you have the problem of transporting it to a recycling facility. It's like transporting air. The stuff is so light, especially when you look at the expanded polystyrene, the styrofoam kind of things. You can't make money filling a truck up with something that light. There's no weight to it. You can't get paid for your load. You've got to densify the stuff to make it denser, and that requires some centralized equipment. So it's very impossible, since it's such a universally used substance, and since it goes to every corner of the world, to get that stuff back in quantity that would give you value for your effort is impossible. So we've been created this monster, and we really don't know what to do with it.
California's legislature passed a plastic bag ban. Will this type of activity help?
Every little bit helps. We've got to build awareness that there's a problem in the first place. Most people attack things like the bottle bills and the bag bills as an attack on their convenience, as an attack on their freedom to do as they please and to have these convenient items. That's because they don't realize the serious consequences of having all this stuff blowing around in the environment. We've got to build awareness of the seriousness of the consequences of waste plastic getting into the environment by highlighting these dirty dozen, if you want to call it that, the most polluting plastic, which are the bags, the bottles, and a lot of the insulated food service things, the clamshells and the styrofoam cups and that sort of thing. You know, we have to go after the worst things first, the things that are showing up the most in our cleanups and so on. And those are the three things that are showing up. Fast food is notorious for having the stuff. We don't have trash compactors in our cars. We should, because people live in their cars. They consume food in their cars, and there's no place to put the trash. So typically the door gets open and it gets shoved. People are confronted with waste everywhere. Plastic is a space hog. It takes up more room in the landfill than anything else. And every time there's an event, the trash cans overflow because it's such a space hog. You can't really provide enough receptacles to safely contain it. It's going to be blowing around on the ground after any large public event. So there's a myriad problems with dealing with it, and banning those things that are the first ones that we see when we do our cleanups makes sense.
What are the other potential solutions?
We have to look at a revolution in design. The product must be designed with end of life in mind. We have to have a circular economy. There must be a pre-cycling premium paid by the producers of this material so that they have an incentive to design it so that it's easy to pick up. We can't just externalize forever the costs of cleaning up pollutants that we make as part of our industrial system. Our industrial system has produced miraculous change in the way humans live, but it's at the expense of the natural world. And if we want to have really that non-synthetic habitat exist for ourselves, we don't have a lot of time because we're turning the entire planet into a synthetic habitat. There are places in the world where people really never get out of a synthetic habitat and never really get to experience anything that could be considered natural. They don't care because they don't ever see the natural world as having value. The value is all part of their synthetic lifestyle. I'm very pessimistic because we're creating generations of city dwellers who don't experience any value in the things that we're screwing up with our trash. So they're not incentivized to do anything about it.
Charles Moore, I'd like to thank you for doing this research and sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you for having me today.
When we come back, how does the civil service serve as a constitutional check on presidential power? Stay tuned.
President Lahaya, oh, oh, yes. Change your constitution. President Informa, oh, yes. Better change your constitution. President Dictator, yeah, me now. Change your constitution. American president, oh, yes. Better change your constitution.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Historically, political leaders and the citizens of the United States had turned toward a civil service after being fed up with the spoil system and other problems arising from private companies running those services. With the return to privatizing government services, our next guest suggests we are facing a deeper problem, potentially a constitutional coup. John Michaels is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, John Michaels. It is great to have you back with us.
Thank you.
Last time you were on with us, we briefly talked about your book, Constitutional Coup. We should start with a bit of a review of the thesis, because it's a very provocative title. When you look now, would you say we really are facing a constitutional coup? And if so, how do you see that?
Sure. So the book is a full-throated defense of the 20th century American administrative state. And part of the title is kind of trying to flip the script on what people have said about the 20th century administrative state, which conservative critics have called essentially an illegitimate displacement of the normal constitutional government that they saw established by the framers. And so what my book is aimed to do is to explain the constitutional footing of the American administrative state against all those challenges that say that it was a kind of an improper or illicit imposition, and to explain that actually the real threat to our constitutional order is not from administrative government, but it's from the privatization of that government, which has been taking place really in earnest since the 1980s and carrying forward into today. And so what I mark is actually the destruction of the administrative state as the coup-like event.
So your argument was also that part of the U.S. Republic has been this administrative state, or civil service, as we might call it, but government, the people who run the government. And you thought of this actually in that way all the way back to the framers of the Constitution.
My project is more that that the administrative state, and I'll explain what that is in a second, is completely compatible with all the spirit and the purposes of our Constitution. So let me explain that a little bit. So the administrative state, and you know, we've already started talking about it as, you know, is it synonymous with the civil service? Is it synonymous with bureaucracy? The administrative state is essentially the cluster of agencies that have delegated responsibilities from Congress to exercise all sorts of lawmaking and law enforcing powers. So when you think about environmental regulation or banking regulation, or you think about the disbursement of housing benefits or educational subsidies, all of that is authorized by legislatures. And then the work itself is funneled into agencies to carry out those very important tasks. In the beginning of the American story, we had a very small federal government. And the federal government wasn't providing much by way of regulation or public benefits. There were veterans benefits. There were some maritime issues that the federal government, as opposed to the states, had to handle. But we were a relatively libertarian society, and we were very much localist. And so if there was going to be regulation, it was going to be done at the state and local level. Notwithstanding all that, some historians say, hey, look, ever since Washington, we've had various regulatory responsibilities embedded in what have become agencies. That's, you know, think about Alexander Hamilton in Treasury or the federal land offices out west. I don't want to say my story is inconsistent with a historical narrative, but mine is more of a constitutional theory project, which says that the framework for the 20th century administrative state aligns quite consistently with the framework for our original much smaller federal government that was structured around a national legislature, a president, and a federal judiciary.
So, John Michaels, you did trace some of the developments of public services from having been private, then being transformed or developed into public services. And one of them was bounty hunters into police forces. Can you walk us through that and what it tells us?
Yeah. So one of the reasons why, and this kind of dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about as well, one of the reasons why I don't put too much weight on the early history in practice is because the early history is very, very different from ours, what we understand for today. So most of the services, in part because the federal government was so small, most of the services such that they existed were done much, on a much more ad hoc basis. And the government, they said the government was in charge, would cobble together a group of individuals to help carry out a given task. So this is, again, to go to the kind of Old West narrative, this was bounty hunters, this was posses, because it was just a sheriff and maybe a deputy. So what happened when the kind of bad guys came to town? You'd have to round up citizens to help out. This was all sorts of ways in which private actors were engrafted onto a relatively primitive state at that point to carry out responsibilities that by the time we get to the 20th century, we just assume the government has taken over. Now, part of what changed between the 19th century and the 20th century was the electorate. So it wasn't just white property males who were voting. And when that happens, all of a sudden, new sets of issues and concerns that matter are brought before, let's say, the legislature's attention. And groups that are more dependent on the state, more vulnerable to the vicissitudes of the market, are going to clamor for a more comprehensive state to mediate all sorts of relationships that are tough for many people to navigate. As we had industrialization, we had a need for greater economic regulation. As we decided we wanted to be more progressive as a matter of civil rights and civil liberties, we needed the state to be more muscular in protecting those rights. So by the time we go from the 19th century, when we had these kind of shady bounty hunters, and we also had during this time, we had, you know, privateers that were basically, you know, some of our frontline defense during the world of 1812, as opposed to just because we had a very small military footprint, to having a major federal infrastructure by the 20th century. To me, that matters a whole lot because it shows the maturation and development of our country and a recognition that the public needs to take some kind of comprehensive responsibility for essentially mediating the challenges of life in a sophisticated political economy. And we get to the 20th century, it matters that these actors are public and are publicly responsible because now we have a fully empowered or more fully empowered electorate. The courts are open and we want to have transparency is more achievable. And we want to have public actors, not random private actors who are picked up on an ad hoc basis to do some jobs for the government, centrally involved. And that's how, you know, slowly but surely we developed a professional administrative state where true experts would show up and do their work and only do that work and not have side jobs in private industry or whatever, carrying out essentially the mission of the state. And for me, the mark of the modern American state starts with, in the 1930s, with this rise of a professional, dedicated, highly politically accountable administrative state.
It sounded like you were also saying that during the late 19th century, people were really frustrated with the private actors that they thought were corrupt and unprofessional and didn't really fully understand the task that they were dealing with for a public citizenry. What was going on then?
Yeah, so that's another, you know, all these threads are so interesting to pull out. We could spend an hour talking about each of these. So what was happening, particularly in the post Civil War period, the postbellum period, is industrialization started, the franchise expanded, and people became a little bit more sensitive to the way politics were being handled in this country. And there was a lot of frustration with the services or the let's say the inadequacy or the inconsistencies or the abuses attendant to the services that the federal government started providing. Now, I will say I would actually paint with a little bit broader brush. There was frustration with these private actors, but there was plenty of frustration with the government employees at this time as well, because those government employees were still products of what we call the old spoil system, which were, they were political hires from top to bottom who were, you know, very handy on the campaign trail for whoever, you know, whatever president won or whatever influential senators had a sway over the White House. And these were political guys, well, you know, men at that point, you know, so political actors whose kind of payment for being good on the electoral campaign was to get a job in the government, get a good paying job in the government. But they weren't professional civil servants. They didn't have the education, nor did they have the kind of long-term commitment, because they knew they would have to go out in 2 years or 2.5 years, or if they're working for members of Congress, a year and a half to start working on campaigns again. So they didn't develop the expertise. They didn't have the same fear of being challenged for being not strong workers because they were backed by very powerful political bosses. And so service was rather suspect. So all of clamoring for this professionalization was not only dissatisfaction with the private actors, but also with a rather, let's say, less than fully professional public cohort as well. So the touchstone for me about the public bureaucracy is not simply that they have a government paycheck, but that they're essentially put into a situation where they are true public servants who are serving larger aims than their political bosses, and quite different aims. And this will become very important when we start talking about the rivalries that are so important today, when about checking, overzealous or hyper-partisan agency heads that want to take a federal agency and basically run it into the ground, why the independence of the civil servant is so important.
The transparency, the consistency, yeah, et cetera. Is there a sense of a spoils system coming back alongside this privatization?
Yeah. So, okay, now fast forward to today. And so the story today is, just to fill in the gaps for folks who might be interested in reading the book or and figuring out where we're going with this. So the story is, in the 20th century, we developed this big public bureaucracy. Obviously, I'm a fan of it. I think it works pretty well. And then when we get starting into the 80s, it starts getting chipped away. And it gets chipped away by a return to outsourcing. And also, and we'll get into that, I hope, and also what you're referencing, which is the kind of reemergence of a public bureaucracy that's no longer as bureaucratically upright as it once was, because we're allowing politics to inform hiring and firing decisions. I take that's what you're getting at. And yes, that poses the exact same problems that we're creating. Or the fear is, if we become less vigilant about the importance of an independent bureaucracy, and we are becoming much less vigilant about it, the fear is we will entertain the prospects of a neo-spoil system that comes back in and becomes very hackish. And frankly, we're seeing that today. We're seeing that today in part just because of attrition, because a lot of good people can't stand to work for this administration. And who's signing up to work for the government right now are people who are true believers in the president's agenda. So we're getting a little of it simply by the demoralization of the bureaucracy. But alongside that, the president in the State of the Union address this January basically called for greater presidential power over the hiring and firing of civil servants, which is the beginning of the end of the civil service.
So forgive me for ping-ponging around a little bit, because I'm going to want to go back and forth about how this actually happened. But I want to sort of address something kind of, since you brought it to Trump and what's currently happening now, starting in the 80s, which is where you point to Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher making government the enemy, it has become a meme that seems to have developed now into a full-throated anti-government conspiratorial view, which is something you've addressed in a blog also, this idea of a deep state conspiring. Now we have the phenomenon of QAnon, which is part of this, and a lot of people are starting to buy onto this and calling for a constitutional convention to overhaul the U.S. Constitution. Do you see it as this escalation to the anti-government memes of Reagan and Thatcher?
So all roads lead to Trump, apparently, anyway. So let me fight the question a little bit. Let's start with Reagan and Thatcher, because in some ways, the movement was a coherent movement before we entered this period of, as you classify it, kind of like heightened anti-government paranoia, concerns about, these conspiracy theorists, fears of a deep state, all this stuff. It's not necessarily true that that was going to be the natural outgrowth of what Reagan and Thatcher were promoting. So let's talk a little bit about them and then see how things went, where things went off the rail again, as it were. So in the 60s and 70s, the administrative state in the United States became quite robust. It's never as robust as, say, continental Europe, but it was quite robust. And in the 70s, things happened that kind of challenged that consensus of support. So one of the things that happened is the economy stalled. Another thing that happened is that the second push of kind of big American welfare benefits were targeting groups that weren't folded into the first New Deal. And this is mostly people of color. It became more gendered. And so some of the old New Deal supporters kind of parted ways a little bit with the new agenda, the new left agenda, as it were. So you lost some supporters. You gained some critics as the economy tightened. Businesses mobilized. Today, we think about businesses being the most politically savvy institutions in the world. For a long time, businesses had their head in the sand. And starting in the 70s, they really developed a kind of savvy strategic plans to challenge government, to challenge government regulation, to challenge taxes, all that stuff. So we get this kind of perfect storm of bad economics, kind of messy demographic situations with a predominantly white concern with changing demographics and power dynamics in America on the heels of the Civil Rights Revolution. And you get this kind of pushback. Reagan comes in and starts running his, he ran first in 76, but he runs and wins in 1980. And he says, you guys have it all wrong. We've had it all wrong for too long. The government is not our ally. The government is our enemy. We need to get the government out of our lives. It's holding us back. It's depriving us of our liberty. I'm going to deregulate. I'm going to privatize. I'm going to do everything that I see my good friend over in the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher, doing with some success. Now, Thatcher ran her campaigns against the nanny state. She criticized this kind of cradle to grave support, and she cut back on many services. She privatized many of the state-owned industries, and Reagan said, let's do that too. Reagan doesn't get that far, though, because we have a system of checks and balances, and so Congress pushes back. People say, well, you can't go that far. So he pivots away from deregulation and more to privatizing services and getting corporations to carry out responsibilities that the government previously did. And he thought it would save a buck. And by and large, it looked good. It looked like he was lowering the number of federal responsibilities, but he was really just transferring them essentially to other actors. Okay. And this seemed like a very ideological push. But then Bill Clinton becomes president. And lo and behold, instead of reversing course on the Reagan agenda, he buys into it. He doubles down on it. And he basically mainstreams it. And he doesn't talk about it in terms of the ideological thunder that Reagan and Thatcher brought. He said, this is smarter, more technocratic government. We should run government like a business. And that message is much more successful than Reagan's ideologically charged message. So Clinton kind of sweeps out the baggage of partisanship, makes it kind of a plan that moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans can buy into it. And it just goes forward. It goes forward under George W. Bush, and it goes forward under Obama. And when I was writing the book, fully expecting Hillary Clinton to win, I thought more of the same. So there is a way in which this story does not have to be the Reagan story, because in the interim, Clinton, Bush, and Obama essentially turn it into something else. Now, I think it's equally devastating regardless of how it's packaged. But we didn't have to go down this conspiratorial road at all. Then Donald Trump comes in and he takes it obviously to new and different heights. He runs against what he calls a swamp, and he's going to drain the swamp, and they're going to get rid of the administrative state, and they're going to get rid of all the interlopers that are occupying the administrative state, and government is the enemy. And then as the government pushes back on him, as they're in part of my constitutional story, as they're not only expected to do, but that's what legitimates their presence in the government, is as a check and balance on the president. He doubles down on these attacks because his hand chosen Secretary of Interior handles a lot of issues on climate change and a lot of issues on land use, and his EPA administrator and his Secretary of Education, they want to gut everything. And all these civil servants who are professionals are pushing back and saying, we don't have the statutory authority to do that. You don't have the science to support what you want to do. You don't have the precedents in place to do that. And it's very frustrating for many people, and certainly someone with the temperament that our president seems to have. So he goes to war. He just ratchets up the rhetoric. And he basically pulls off the shelf a lot of the Reagan rhetoric and just turns it up about 100 degrees. And then we get all this, you know, then the media gets swept into it and the intelligence community gets swept into it. And everyone who's not with President Trump is against him. And that, by and large, that's a lot of the administrative state. So I do want to say that, like, there is a, we could tell a story as this is an inevitable march from Reagan to Trump, but that almost normalizes what Donald Trump is doing. And I don't want to do that.
I certainly wasn't suggesting that that was what was happening, but certainly the groundwork was laid by this meme that got planted back in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and interests who benefit. And you lay out some of these benefits from privatizing, you know, government services. I mean, you've talked about who benefits from this, who doesn't benefit from this, and how it empowers what, you know, you really referenced as bullies being able to bully more. And I think that empowerment and the way that media work, especially now with the internet and not the same gatekeepers as we used to have, has then taken it to this place where now we have former Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, you know, calling for this constitutional convention, saying we're either going to become a Marxist country or we're going to be free. So we have to have this, you know, constitutional convention. And so it's been ratcheted up to such a pitch point.
I agree. And those points are well made and well taken. I think one of the challenges is that privatization is such a powerful tool that the original architects of it, who were mostly economists, who were saying, look, you know, they weren't ideologues in terms of anti-government. They were skeptics of government because they thought bureaucracy didn't work well. And they thought bureaucracy didn't work well because it wasn't subject to the all-powerful and all-logical forces of the market. So they said, look, government bureaucracies are pathological because they're bureaucracies. You should give these responsibilities to corporations and watch how human development flourishes, because the market is logical and the public sector is dysfunctional. When Reagan picks that up, he runs with that, and it starts to change from that kind of notion of kind of an academic exercise into something that has political traction. And as it gets time and time further and further along, it becomes less about efficiency and more about power. So then we see the fact, and this is where the bullying point comes in. Originally, the issues with privatization was, oh, are they going to empower private actors too much? Because we're turning over all these responsibilities to private actors, and who knows what's going to happen with it. But then it became pretty clear that any smart government official who is holding the contract in his or her hands has a lot more power, because the contractors, you know, whether it's a military contractor, an environmental inspection agency, or anything else, the contractors are much more likely to be obsequious, yes, men and women, to the political bosses than are the bureaucrats. We've talked around it, but civil servants are protected against at-will termination. They can't be fired because they have a political disagreement with their bosses. That's a foundational element of our civil service and many civil services. Now, if you have a contractor who's working on a contract, he or she's basically the equivalent of an at-will employee. So if you go to the federal bureaucrat and say, we need to make this climate change report disappear, they're going to say, no dice, I'm not going to do it. You say it to a contractor, and the contractor's thinking, my contract's up in about 3 weeks, I'd really like another one. The conversation goes in a very different direction. So smart, savvy government officials use contracting not because there might be some economic efficiencies there may or they may not, but because they have greater control, because they control the fates of those contractors in a way they don't control the fates of civil servants. So that becomes the lens in which people who are not necessarily neoclassical economists buy into privatization, because they think the president should have more control over government. And that sounds really nice. If you're someone like me, that might sound really nice under a president like President Barack Obama. And it sounds maybe okay under Hillary Clinton, but it sounds devastating and has become devastating under Donald Trump. Now, again, I wrote this book fearful of any president having this type of power because I think it's inconsistent with our constitutional norms. But you can understand why, if you think that there's responsible leadership, Republican or Democrat, you can understand why you'd want the president to have a freer hand. We just elected him or her. We shouldn't have so much bureaucratic pushback. So let's minimize the friction and allow the president to put in his or her team and really implement whatever the agenda happens to be. But there's two problems with that. One is you might get a bully who's going to take the country off the deep end. But the second reason, which is more predictable than the bully one, is it's simply inconsistent with our system of checks and balances. The bureaucracy is a check on the president. In the 19th century, Congress was a check on the president. In the 20th century, Congress doesn't do as much work because it's given all this power to the agencies. So the agencies, if they're just a, if they're just pawns of the president, we have essentially a government that we elect usually like, but, you know, the president wins 49% of the popular vote or something like that, or maybe 51%, and then takes the country in any direction he or she chooses. In fact, the bureaucracy is a moderating force. The bureaucracy is a counter-majoritarian force that smooths out those differences because we are not a country like a parliamentary system that switches on a dime between, say, a Tory government and a Whiggish government. We can hew more to the center. And so to gut the bureaucracy, to take away that failsafe of moderation.
And I would just add to that, that when it's private actors versus public actors, there are three more things that you've actually touched on, but I'll just emphasize here as well, which is the purpose of a private company is different from the purpose of a public entity. And then the check on the private entity is different from the check on a public entity, meaning the democratic process does not apply to a private entity. And finally, the transparency issue.
Yeah. So first of all, I'll sign on to all three of those points, just to be clear on that. The reason why I de-emphasize those a little bit in our conversation is in part because I want to underscore how important the kind of institutional design of the federal bureaucracy is. So it's not just that it's their government and not private actors. They're government actors who are tenured, likely to serve their whole careers in the bureaucracy. And that gives them a special standing. It gives them legal standing to push back. It gives them kind of, they're subsumed within a cultural ethos of loyal but not subordinate service, where they are able to say, hey, boss, I hear what you're saying, but that just doesn't fly. So the institutional setting in which our public bureaucracy is matters a whole lot. Insofar as if you told me, well, what if we just made all the contractors, what if we just all gave them federal paychecks and all made them subject to the Freedom of Information Act? And federal conflicts of interest law. That would not be enough for me. So I agree with all three of your points. But to me, it's even, I would stress it even more that even if you could say to me that we could basically bump up private actors and in some way make them more politically, legally, or culturally accountable, I would still say that's not enough. And that's important because I'm very fearful that a non-privatized bureaucracy that is no longer protected by federal civil service laws is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for tyranny as well. Because without those protections, the civil servants are essentially spoils appointments waiting to happen. So no matter how they were hired, if they start disagreeing with the president, they're gone and they'll be replaced by someone who's going to be more amenable. And when a new president comes in, he or she's going to clean the deck and put in his or her loyalist. I don't want loyalists in the bureaucracy. I don't want loyalists to a president. I want loyalists to the Constitution, to the agency, to the mission that Congress has given to them. And that type of loyalty requires distance from the political bosses who sit in the White House.
There's also another point of view that the United States is becoming more like a plutocracy. Do you think there is evidence for that? And does your argument about this sort of privatization feed that?
Certainly in the kind of loose colloquial sense of plutocracy, we are veering in that direction. We've been veering in that direction for a while. It's a function of the underlying economic inequality and our educational inequality. It's evident in the way that campaign finances are structured, the way we allow fundraising, the way we allow campaigns to be run in this country, and by basically some degree of, let's say, political apathy that's allowed powerful interests to wield even more power than they otherwise would be able to buy on their own. So yes, we are in, this is not a good position to be in by any stretch. How does this shape out with privatization? I think it certainly is consistent with the early story of privatization, which is, most plutocrats, but not all, have an overriding faith in the private sector being superior to the government and in a distrust of government. And I think that plays a role in the agenda to assume that civil servants, that federal regulation are potential problems as opposed to solutions. Of course, that's not always the case. You can have very influential liberal donors who want to expand the state. But in fact, we haven't seen much of that. And so let's say high profile liberal private wielders of influence have sought to do different things. So take Mark Zuckerberg, who I think professes to be quite progressive on a lot of issues. So Mark Zuckerberg has there's a very kind of famous case study of his investment in the Newark, New Jersey public schools. And he gave a lot of money to Newark, but he put all these strings attached to them. This wasn't going to be, here, Newark, you run your schools. You know, we recognize that you're a very poor, challenged community for a variety of reasons, structural, economic, racial, all sorts of reasons. Here, go, you know, fix your schools, do your thing. No, he put all these kind of business-like strings attached to it, where there'd be the members of the Zuckerberg nonprofit would oversee the hiring of teachers, would check on kind of the way curricula are written and various kind of, you know, market-based metrics of success. So there is this idea that, you know, if money is the kind of currency of political discourse and money generally stems from the marketplace, folks are going to assume that the market is a better vehicle for whatever your definition of progress or human improvement or social flourishing is, that the market will be the pathway. Two problems with that. One is that, you know, maybe that's not true. I mean, obviously, I don't think that's true. But the second thing is privatization is not necessarily the best vehicle for having a market-based government for precisely the reasons I've said. You can have a tyrant in the government who uses privatization to enhance government power precisely because it lessens the kind of pushback that federal bureaucrats would otherwise be offering to an overzealous president.
Speaking of overzealous presidents, now in the past, it wasn't even that long ago that we had spoken before, you had suggested that there is some pushback as a result of the rise of Donald Trump. Do you still think this? Or do you think that it has empowered the anti-government pushing towards restricting federal government even further?
So I think the answer is both. I think we have more pushback and more hard charging. I think we have people hard charging on both sides. And I don't think that's, there's any reason why those would be exclusive of one another. In fact, it makes sense. So we have people really, you know, protesting. We see insurgent campaigns in Democratic primaries. We see high-level bureaucratic departures and various forms of, you know, leaks and protests and whatnot. And we also see the steady march of deregulation, and we see the intensification of the demonization of certain institutions in our country, including judges and civil servants and members of the media. And so we're seeing more of that. Will this, and I know that you've been kind of teasing this question and I haven't answered it, so let me do it now. Is this going to go to a constitutional convention? I don't think so. I don't think it's a good time to do a constitutional convention. And I don't think it's a good time to do a constitutional convention because my interests would lose, though I think that's probably true. I don't think you have a constitutional convention at a moment of flux. And to say whether you want to say that this is a good flux or a bad flux, we're in a flux. This is not a stable moment where we have time to sit back and kind of assess what's going on and where we want to go from here. Things are way too volatile and way too heated to have something like this. We haven't been a country that has rewritten the Constitution whole cloth. So there's also a kind of, there's a cultural question there as well, that like, why are we going to scrap this thing right now? What has happened now that warrants a rewrite? Whether you're a democratic socialist who now, you know, thinks that every president going forward is a future Donald Trump, or you're someone who wants to make sure the deep state never comes such as it doesn't exist. But if you're fearful of a deep state that is doing sorts of things, that how do we make sure we ban a deep state from the future? This is not the moment. And I don't think we're at the kind of cusp of true deliberation about that. And if we were, I would, you know, obviously I would oppose it at least in the short term and perhaps the long term. But so I don't mean to not take your question seriously, but it strikes me as, so one, I would say it strikes me as implausible, with the caveat that a lot of things that many people thought were implausible are being realized at a kind of a pace that no one can keep up with. So nothing's impossible, but I think there are more immediate questions on the horizon about where this country is going, irrespective of whether there'd be a convention. That's kind of my take home on that. I haven't given it too much thought, but that's probably where I come down.
John Michaels, it's always a pleasure to host you. I so appreciate you joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks for having me back.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Big man.